So what I'm going to talk about today is not exactly about social inequalities in health, at least not in its and not at first glance, but it actually is about social inequalities in health. It's about the unequal social distribution of global ecological change, and that's very much embedded in this. And it's also about the relationship between the social determinants of health and the ecological determinants of health. So I'm going to cover all of that and have time for questions. So this is what I'm going to talk about. I'm going to talk about what the Anthropocene is. How many people here have heard the word Anthropocene? Okay, so for some it's an entirely new idea. How many people know what it means and what it is? Oh, great, I love audiences like this. Good. I'm going to talk about what we, in our report for the Canadian Public Health Association, called the ecological determinants of health, and what are, in the report, we talk about what are the key ecological changes underway, what are the human driving forces, that's the social dimension to this, that are creating those changes, what are the health and human development impacts of that, and then a section about imagination and hope, because up to point five, it's pretty much grim, doom and gloom, bad news. But we can't stay there. We can't land there. We need to be thinking about, well, if that's what it looks like it is, or if that's how it is, how do we change that? How do we imagine a different and better future? How do we generate hope? And then I'm going to talk a bit about the public health agenda at the end. Our audience for this CPHA report is in fact the public health profession largely. So we didn't write this report, which I'll come back to in a minute, for the general public. We're really trying to engage the public health profession and the population health research and practice world. So what is the Anthropocene? Well, our efforts to subdue nature have been so successful that geologists are actually suggesting we are in a new geologic epoch, and that actually we have been for maybe 150 years. The beginning of it you can trace back, as you'll see in a minute, to the Industrial Revolution, and in particular to what is called the Great Acceleration that happened in the 1950s, starting in the 1950s, and that we are now very much embedded in. So what they're saying is that the impact that we are having on the Earth is so profound that it will show up in the geological record millions of years into the future. You will be able to point to a geologic strata and say that was the beginning of the Anthropocene, just like we can do that for the Holocene and the Pleistocene and all of those other geologic epochs. The difference is we've actually created this geologic epoch, hence the Anthropocene. And so rather than try to explain it in great detail, I'll start with a short video that will do that for you.
This is the story of how one species changed a planet. The latest chapter of our story begins in England 250 years ago. Fueled by coal, then oil, several brilliant inventions appeared. They ignited the Industrial Revolution, which spread like wildfire through Europe, North America, Japan, then elsewhere. The great railways, then cars and highways, connected people across the globe. Medical discoveries saved millions of lives. New artificial fertilizers meant we could feed more people. Population rose rapidly. But this was nothing compared with what was to come. The 1950s marked the beginning of the Great Acceleration. Globalization, marketing, tourism, and huge investments helped fuel enormous growth. People swarmed to cities, which became even more powerful engines of creativity. In a single lifetime, the well-being of millions has improved beyond measure. Health, wealth, security, longevity, never have so many had so much. Yet 1 billion are malnourished. In a single lifetime, we have grown into a phenomenal global force. We move more sediment and rock annually than all natural processes, such as erosion and rivers. We manage 3/4 of all land outside the ice sheets. Greenhouse gas levels this high have not been seen for over 1 million years. Temperatures are increasing. We have made a hole in the ozone layer. We are losing biodiversity. Many of the world's deltas are sinking due to damming, mining, and other causes. Sea level is rising. Ocean acidification is a real threat. We are altering Earth's natural cycles. We have entered the Anthropocene, a new geological epoch dominated by humanity. This relentless pressure on our planet risks unprecedented destabilization. But our creativity, energy, and industry offer hope. We have shaped our past. We are shaping our present. We can shape our future. You and I are part of this story. We are the first generation to realize this new responsibility. As the population grows to 9 billion, we must find a safe operating space for humanity, for the sake of future generations. Welcome to the Anthropocene.
That's pretty sobering. One of the lines that always strikes me in that is the comment that we move more materials than all of the planetary forces of erosion and sedimentation carried by rivers. We exceed natural processes of moving raw materials like that. That's really quite scary, actually, that we're that powerful. And in many other ways as well. Notice, incidentally, this was prepared for a conference in 2012 in London. The scientific sponsors include some major national scientific organizations such as the International Council for Scientific Unions and the International Geosphere Biosphere Program and things like that. So these are not amateurs who are doing this work. Okay, so let me get back into here. So, it's in that context, and incidentally, I should say something else about this, which is that the Anthropocene, although it's a geological concept, is more than that, and we're using it really as a metaphor, and many others are as well, as a metaphor for both what humans are doing to the planet and what our responsibility is in response to that situation, and what are the implications of that for humanity. So Naomi Klein wrote a book about climate change recently called This Changes Everything. She's only talking about climate change. This is bigger. Much bigger than climate change. It includes climate change, but it's more than that. And so if climate change changes everything, this sure as heck changes everything. So the Anthropocene is a useful social metaphor as well as a geologic metaphor. So in our report, we looked at, or what we tried to do is document the potential health impacts of a set of major ecological changes that you see here, climate and atmospheric change, which includes obviously global warming, but also pollution and ecotoxicity, and I'll come back to ecotoxicity a little bit, resource depletion, and loss of biodiversity. These are the big four things. There's actually a fifth that we added, which I haven't added here and I should, and that's ocean acidification, which is a consequence of fossil fuel emissions, but it's not actually a climate change issue, it's really a pollution issue. And what we wanted to do was to identify what are the drivers of these changes and then propose what is public health's responsibility in response to that. So these are the two reports that you can find on the website. On the right is what we call the report in brief, and I led the team that developed this. There's about a dozen authors. That's the 100-page short version of a 450-page report that we're now revising for release this spring. And then on the left is a 30-page discussion paper that boils it all down. Both of those are available on the website. The discussion paper is available in English and French on the CPHA website. You just go to CPHA and you'll find it. At the same time, others are sharing this interest. I just actually saw a note that an organization called Future Earth has now established a health program within Future Earth called Future Earth Health. This was a commission established by the Rockefeller Foundation and the Lancet, looking at the Lancet's been doing a series of commissions, as you may know, in recent years, including two in the last 7 years on climate change, and then this one, which is on this even bigger issue of, as you can see there, human health in the Anthropocene epoch. So they are using the same language. In fact, I was an external reviewer for their report a year ago, and so there's been some cross-fertilization of our report into their report. I think we helped shape some of their thinking because we had been doing it for a couple of years at that point. So what are the ecological determinants of health? Well, many of you will be familiar with the notion of the social determinants of health. And unfortunately, and I think it's unfortunate, what has happened is that what was originally a notion of the determinants of health, which included biology and genetics and healthcare and a bunch of other things, became in fact narrowed down. And it became narrowed down to talking about the social determinants of health. But I can recall Ronald Bonte and I, way back in the 1990s, talking about the fact and writing about the fact that population health was ecologically blind. So the population health discourse was very much about social and economic and political forces, but not about ecological or environmental change. And so it neglected that. And so what we are trying to do in many ways is to counteract that and say you can't be ecologically blind if you're concerned about the health of populations. And we have been, and we need to correct that. We're not trying to throw out the social determinants of health. What we're trying to say is that the social and the ecological completely interact and intersect, and you can't deal with them separately. And that's what we have been doing to this point, largely. So what are the ecological determinants of health? Well, they're pretty fundamental. Starting with air, water, and food. How many of you think we'd last very long without air, water, and food? Where do they come from? They're not social productions. They're produced from natural systems, as are most of the most fundamental things we depend upon for our personal and social well-being. Where does fuel and materials come from? It comes from natural systems. Protection from UV radiation, waste recycling, climate stability, and a whole bunch of other things that we depend upon for our well-being and our life, in fact, come from natural systems. And so to be ecologically blind is to ignore all of this, or to not at least give it enough weight. And so we're trying to rebalance that perspective. So what are some of these key ecological changes? Well, as I said earlier, it's more than climate change, and I've already touched on these. But I think it's really important to understand that, because a lot of our discourse is about climate change. But there's other things going on which are equally important and which actually often interact with climate change. So climate change will drive loss of species as well. Climate change, because, or at least the mechanisms that result in climate change, such which is fossil fuel emissions largely, in turn pollute the ocean and acidify the ocean. They also generate massive air levels of air pollution. And so these are all self-reinforcing systems that are going on, not to mention the depletion of resources. So all of these things tend to feed on each other. Resource depletion leads to habitat destruction, leads to species loss, and so on. And they largely interact negatively, sometimes they don't. So this is some fundamental work by a group of largely geologists and earth system scientists, led by Will Steffen from ANU in Canberra, and from Stockholm, from the Resilience Institute, I think it's called, in Stockholm. In a paper published quite recently last year, they looked at, or they updated actually an earlier paper, looking at 9 Earth system processes, and you can see the 9 there. They largely correspond with the 4 or 5 I've outlined for you. They are dissections of those. The nitrogen and phosphorus cycle is implicit in our categorization, but not explicit as it should be. They also identify what they call here novel entities. So I talked about ecotoxicity. Ecotoxicity is very simple to understand. Every single person in this room carries a body burden of persistent organic pollutants. You have carried it for your whole lives. You were born with a body burden of persistent organic pollutants, those of you who were born less than about 50 or 60 years ago. So our entire ecosystem and the food chains, and remember we sit at the top of food chains, are contaminated with persistent organic pollutants. But there are other novel entities, which is what they're grouping together here. So nanoparticles and genetically modified organisms, they categorize all of that as novel entities. We've created things that nature has never seen before and can't necessarily deal with, which is why persistent organic pollutants persist. They were designed not to be degraded, biodegraded, very deliberately. Not always deliberately, sometimes unintentionally, but often deliberately, certainly to the pesticides. And so they sit there, and then they bioconcentrate up the food chain. So all of these novel entities, they clump them together, which is an interesting way to think about it, at least. And then this is a quite famous chart that they've produced out of this. The red area denotes areas of high risk, areas where we are beyond the bounds of the zone of uncertainty. That's the word the phrase I was after. And what they're saying is that in areas of biogeochemical flows and in areas of species extinction, we are already well into the red area, a high zone of uncertainty. This is based on their estimation of what the planet can sustain. And so they have this notion of planetary boundaries, and we are crossing planetary boundaries for these Earth system processes. And so you'll see that we're in the red zone for 3 of them, we're in the yellow zone and quite well into the yellow zone on land system change, on climate change, and beginning to edge into that on ocean acidification. And then we have some categories where they were unable to establish what planetary boundaries might be. So atmospheric aerosol loading and novel entities and some aspects of biosphere integrity. But the point is, very simply, that we are already crossing or approaching boundaries that we shouldn't be crossing for a number of key Earth system processes that we depend on for the very stuff of life. That's what it means when you start to move materials at the same scale or greater than natural processes. That's what it means when you pollute entire ecosystems with persistent organic pollutants. That's what it means when you raise global temperatures and so on. 2 in particular are what they call core boundaries, climate change and biosphere integrity, which are integrated emergent system level phenomena. That is to say, they interact with each other in a systematic way. They're connected to all of the other planetary boundaries, and they have the potential to drive us into a new state. Now, what do we mean by a new state? Well, one of the scary issues that is hanging out there is this: the possibility of state shift. We tend to assume that change is nice and smooth and linear and logical, and it isn't. In complex adaptive systems, you can hit a tipping point, and then you can have a non-linear, quite dramatic shift. We actually see that in social systems. So I think we saw it, for example, we definitely saw it around the acceptance of gay marriage, which was resisted and resisted and resisted for years, and then suddenly, almost overnight, it was acceptable everywhere. In Ireland, in Italy, in a lot of the states in the US, and so on. So those are quite sudden shifts, and natural systems go through the same thing. So rapid nonlinear change is an emergent property of many complex adaptive systems. We've seen it before, and they tend to accelerate. Another good example is the loss of Arctic sea ice. So as Arctic sea ice melts, you get a much lower albedo, a much lower reflective capacity of the Arctic Ocean. The dark ice-free waters absorb heat better, and so that leads to greater loss of ice. And so it's a positive reinforcement loop that can lead to very dramatic shifts very, very rapidly. So that's the threat of state shifts. So on top of all of the things we have to be concerned about, we also need to recognize the potential for state shift, which largely is unpredictable. And that's part of the problem with it. Here's some key summary statistics. How many people here have heard of the ecological footprint? Concept developed by Bill Rees and Mathis Vakkenagel at UBC in the 80s. And this is a global ecological footprint per capita. Not per capita, total. And what you can see there is the straight line at one is one planet's worth of reproductive biocapacity. That is to say, the ability of biosystems to reproduce what they produce. So we have been exceeding, in effect, the carrying capacity of the planet since about the 1970s. And we continue to do so. We're currently up around 1.5 planets. If the entire population of the Earth lived in the way that we live in North America, we'd need 4 to 5 planets. Now, I don't know about you, but the last time I checked, there weren't any nearby useful planets. We've got one planet. We're going to have to learn to live within it. And right now, we're not doing that. So that's the ecological footprint. And this is where these two intersect. The flip side of this is the Living Planet Index. So both of these indicators are in a biannual report from the Worldwide Fund for Nature, WWF, called the Living Planet Report. This is from their most recent one. There'll be a new one out this year. What you see here is it's a count of the number of the populations of about 10 or 11,000 species, or maybe a bit more than that, 16,000, I forget the exact number, of mammals. Of vertebrates, so mammals, birds, reptiles, amphibians, and fish. It's declined globally 52%. So just as the ecological footprint has gone up, so what we have done is we've squeezed out. We are appropriating more and more of the planet's biocapacity. When we appropriate that, we remove it from other species. And so they decline. And so you've got a 52% decline since 1970 in the Living Planet Index, and in Latin America, that decline is 83%. Clearly, that is not sustainable, and you can see precisely why we have what's being called a sixth great extinction, which we are creating. It's the first great extinction that humans have created. The five previous ones were by natural processes, meteorites or large volcanic eruptions or whatever. So, that, in a nutshell, is what is happening globally. It's not a pretty picture. And what's driving it? Well, we are. This is a famous, equation is really the wrong word, a famous concept from Epstein's back in the 1960s, I think. It goes far back as that. Impact, human impact on natural systems equals population times affluence, times technology. And the more people you have, and the greater their level of affluence, which generally speaking translates into demand upon the Earth's resources, and the more powerful your technology, the ability to change global Earth processes, the greater your impact. And what you see here in at the bottom front of this little box is where we were in 1900 in terms of population, technology, and affluence, where we were in 1950, and where we are today. And you'll see why this phenomenon is called the Great Acceleration. There has been a dramatic increase in all of these things since 1950. One of the things we did in the report was to try and put that into more human terms. And so we said, okay, well, average life expectancy today is about 80, which of course in itself is a fiction. It's not predictive, not at all predictive. It's a measure of average age of death, really. But let's assume that on average an infant born this year is going to live 80 years. What happens if you have what we now have, which is 1% annual population growth? Over 80 years, your population will increase twofold. What about if you have 3% real growth in GDP, which is kind of what the economists and the politicians and the business people are all driving for, some nice, modest growth like that? Well, modest growth like that over 80 years is a tenfold increase in impact. Put those two together and you're talking about a 23-fold increase in our impact on the Earth. Even if our technology was five times as efficient as it is now, we'd still be having a four-fold increase in impact at a time when we already exceed the planet's carrying capacity. So within the lifetime of our children and grandchildren, this is clearly impossible. It's not going to happen. There is, incidentally, Kenneth Boulding, I think it was Kenneth Boulding? Keith Boulding, the economist, once said, anyone who believes that you can have indefinite growth within a finite system is either mad or an economist. And that's where we sit, though. We think we can do this. We can't do this. It is not possible. So we're going to have, to go with the great acceleration, we're going to have to create a great transition from our current path to one that does fit with the limits of the one small Earth that we have. Because there are limits to growth. Some of you may know this famous report, The Limits to Growth, by Club of Rome, issued by the Club of Rome, work done by the MIT team, and released in 1972 at the first UN Conference on the Environment in Stockholm. Chris Turner, who's at the Commonwealth Scientific and Industrial Research Organization in Canberra, Australia, went back and did something that no one else seemed to have done. He took their models, because what they did, what the MIT team did, was a series of models. They did computer modeling of the Earth and its systems, and they ran a number of different scenarios, assuming different factors changed. Their business as usual scenario showed a dramatic collapse of the Earth's ecosystems and our economy in the mid-21st century, which is about 35 years away, a little over a generation from now. And what he did was to go back and say, well, let's see how accurate their predictions were. So he actually took what had actually happened and looked at it in comparison with what they modeled and concluded that they were right, that they were on track, that their business as usual model is what we've been following and that it works, which is not good news for us. So what are the impacts of all of this on health and human development? Well, that's where it gets quite tricky. So those of you who are looking for some nice areas of certainty and facts, you might want to leave the room at this point. What we concluded, and we had in particular Colin Soskolny, who's a well-known environmental epidemiologist, looking at this, and we were all looking at, several of us were looking at this, we have a very limited understanding of what the impacts of all this are. We don't have good data, we don't have good estimates. What we do know is sketchy, preliminary, often speculative. So we don't really have a good handle on what does it mean? What does species loss mean to humans? What is the health impact of a great extinction? Not likely to be good, but can we be any more specific than that? Well, not very, particularly for that one. We do know that the changes we're talking about interact, they multiply, they affect the whole system. So you need you need to understand the overall system change in order to understand the overall health impacts, and we're not at that point yet where we can specify that. But people who have looked at it in depth have said things such as this. This is the Millennium Ecosystem Assessment commissioned by the UN in 2000, reporting in 2005, concluding that human activity is putting such a strain on the natural functions of Earth that the ability of the planet's ecosystems to sustain future generations can no longer be taken for granted. We've always taken it for granted. We can no longer do that. If you've got kids or grandkids, that's a pretty scary statement. The Lancet Commission, the Rockefeller Lancet Commission, when they looked at it, one of the issues they dealt with is the fact that part of the comeback we get on this, and I can remember getting this from the chemical industry when I talked about ecotoxicity and other people did 30 or 40 years ago, was, what are you complaining about? Life expectancy is still increasing. We don't have a problem. And there's some of that right now. You get this notion that, well, what are you talking about? Life expectancy around the planet is going up, health is improving. What's your problem? Well, the problem is, as they put it here, that we've been mortgaging the health of future generations to get economic and development gains today. So we are mortgaging the future. We're doing well, but we're doing well because we're exceeding the planet's carrying capacity, and for a while you can get away with that, and we're reaping the benefits of that. But in the longer term, that's not a sustainable strategy. So we need to be clear that, yes, things might look like they're getting better, but that's because you're not taking a long enough perspective to understand this, and you're not taking a systems view to understand this. So our ultimate message is this, that the population health impacts of this are large, they're, we think, at least comparable to the impact of the social determinants, and more importantly, they intersect with and interact with the social determinants. The other thing I should say, and we talk about it more in the report than I've talked about it here, that those impacts are, of course, inequitably socially distributed. Who's going to get impacted most by this? People who are poor and vulnerable and disadvantaged anywhere in the world. The wealthy will do okay. Some years ago, I was in Singapore, 20 years ago, talking to them about this, talking to them about sea level rise, because it's a small, low-lying island nation. They weren't troubled. They said, "Meh, we're rich, we'll just build dikes like the Dutch, we'll be fine." They're probably right, because they're rich. That's not going to happen in Bangladesh, in the deltas there. So the poor will be the victims of this to a much greater extent than the rich will be. So, having spelled out enough doom and gloom to last a lifetime, or several lifetimes, what do we do in response? Well, what we talk about, and I don't go into it in great detail here, but what we talk about in our report is the need for imagination. We need to be able to imagine a better future. And for those of us who've been involved in creating healthy communities, sustainable communities, green communities, any of that kind of work, we've all actually been imagining a better future and trying to create it. That's what we do. And so there's actually a great deal of work that's been done about what we need to change and how we need to change it. And we know a lot, and that's part of the point of hope, we know a lot about what needs to be done. The fact that we've lost 40 or 50 years since the 1972 Stockholm Conference, that, for example, the limits to growth argument was pushed away by the business sector, government sector, economists as being a bunch of baloney. Well, it wasn't. But we do need both imagination to imagine what that better future might be, and then we need a sense of hope. And I like this definition from actually two of my medical colleagues who were writing about Canada's healthcare system, but they commented that hope is the commitment to positivity in the face of adversity. And that's what we are trying to do. You have to stay positive in the face of this negative scenario. If you don't, you just may as well throw your hands up, walk away, and live a hell of a life and go. But that's not what I'm going to do, and what any of us are going to do, I hope. So what are the messages of hope? Well, the first is that there are some very significant health gains, or health co-benefits, as they're sometimes called, to moving to a more ecologically sustainable way of life. And we give some examples in there. So, for example, active transportation rather than cars. Better for health, better for the environment, better in all sorts of ways, even better for social exchange. John Sewell, the former mayor of Toronto back in the 80s when I worked in Toronto, I recall him describing the TTC, the Toronto Transit System, as the great democratizer, which was a social role of transport I had not thought of to that point. And his point was that because the system was good, everybody used it. Young and old, rich and poor, black and white, male and female, everybody used it. And you literally rubbed shoulders with your whole community. And he saw that as an important social function. And I think he's right. So there are benefits to public transit, mass transit. There are benefits to a low-meat diet. So a low-meat diet is needed ecologically because meat production is a very ecologically damaging way of doing things, particularly feedlot beef, and which is in all your burgers. And at the same time, there's significant health benefits of a low-meat diet. So we can move to a more sustainable society and reap a whole bunch of health benefits. Similarly with fossil fuel use. So we can switch to clean energy, renewables, conservation, and all of that. And in doing that, there's a whole bunch of health gains. Everything from the fact that those kinds of energy systems are much more labor intensive, actually generate much more employment. They generate more employment in less skilled trades. You don't have to be a nuclear engineer to run the thing. And they generate local and locally dispersed employment. Bicycle manufacturing, the same thing, and so on. So there's all sorts of benefits. Secondly, we've done this before. On a small scale, we've done it, for example, around tobacco. So 30 years ago, 40 years ago, there probably would have been ashtrays in the room, people smoking, that would have been all normal, socially acceptable. We made smoking socially unacceptable. It was quite a dramatic shift, and it happened relatively quickly. That's a small-scale example, but the point is we've done major, fairly major social change. If you go back even further, if you look at what the slums and the industrial cities of England and later of Europe and North America looked like in the mid-19th century, they weren't very different from what you'd see in Delhi today or anywhere else where you have large informal settlements and slums. So we changed that. Public health, urban planning, and a whole bunch of other folks, social reformers, changed that, and changed that quite rapidly in 50 years. It's still not perfect, it's still not the best it could be, but it's a hell of a lot better than it was in 1840. So we've done it before. We're not alone is the third reason for hope. Lots of partners. As it happened, coming out here yesterday, I found myself sitting on the plane next to Seven Suzuki, David Suzuki's daughter, who made a very moving speech at the UN as a young woman 20 years ago or more. They're part of our partners. They're people we need to work with. The environmental movement has done the work of public health in this area for the last 30 or 40 years, and public health has been largely absent from that. In fact, often, not often, but certainly from time to time, in opposition to the environmental movement. We can't do that. The environmental movement is leading this. We need to be part of that. It's no good us coming in and saying, we're here, we're public health, we're going to save the day. We're too late coming to this party, but we need to be at this party, and we need to go there now. But we're not alone. We have lots of partners, not just in the environmental movement, social entrepreneurship, environmental entrepreneurs who are creating the new economy that we need. Fourthly, and I've touched on this, we already know what needs to be done. We've known for a very long time what needs to be done. So it's not lack of knowledge about what to do or even how to do it. Our implementation has been weak in the face of very powerful opposition from very powerful forces in the economic sector and in governments. And we have to change that. And then finally, another source of hope is we have made progress. There's, in fact, lots of examples of these kind of changes, of social entrepreneurship, of creating more sustainable cities and towns and villages and neighborhoods and all the rest of it. So we need to be going there. We're going to have to do a whole bunch of things on the way, and I will. There is a whole public health agenda that goes with this, which I don't really have time to get into. I've touched on the health co-benefits. But I will just leave it with this. The model we put forward in the report is a very simple model. It simply says that ecological determinants and social determinants interact with each other. Each of them also drives population health changes. And that if we're going to take action to improve the health of populations, we have to take action on ecological issues, on social issues. We have to, more importantly, adopt an eco-social approach and understand that these things are tightly linked, that we can't any longer think of the ecological over here and the social over here as if they were different. It's social changes that drive ecological change, and ecological change will harm many of our social gains. And so I will leave it at that. If there's time later on, I can always go back and pick up some of the actual public health agenda. Let me just say, as I said at the outset, our target in this report is not the general public. It actually is the public health profession, because we feel the public health profession is not there yet, has not been here, has not been part of this process. If we can't engage and bring along and gain the power of the public health movement and public health professionals and public health organizations in addressing this, how are we going to convince anybody else? So our first target is, how do we engage public health professionals and organizations in understanding the ecological determinants of health and the need for a great transition that public health needs to be part of to a more sustainable, healthier, and more just future? Thank you.